Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Hard to believe, but 9/11 happened 15 years ago. The anniversary is coming up on Sunday. Remembering back, it seemed the day had started with weather typical for mid-September, sunny and beautiful. But the mood, of course, quickly turned to one of disbelief and horror as the pictures began to come in of smoke pouring from the World Trade Center towers. Planes hijacked by terrorists rammed into the buildings and the western face of the Pentagon, and a fourth plane was driven into a field outside the village of Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Nearly 3,000 people died, surpassing the death toll at Pearl Harbor by hundreds. For many of us, it doesn't seem possible so much time has passed, and yet since then, the tallest building in North America has risen where the Twin Towers once stood, One World Trade Center. The man believed to have been the mastermind of 9/11, Osama bin Laden, was hunted down and killed by Navy SEALs, and the terror group Al-Qaeda has been replaced by ISIS as the modern face of terror. Everybody who lived through 9/11 seems to have a story about where they were and who they were with. And this hour, we're going to talk about not only what happened then, but what the lasting effects are today. In studio with us are Ellen Saraceni. Her husband, Victor, was captain of United Flight 175, which was hijacked and then flown into the World Trade Center's South Tower. Ellen lives in Bucks County and helped to develop a memorial garden in Lower Makefield, and she has pushed for pilot safety legislation in Washington. Ellen Saraceni, so good of you to join us for Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And Chris Brennan writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He covered the events of 9/11 for the Philadelphia Daily News. Chris, welcome back to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And Stephen Brock is a professor and the School Psychology Program Coordinator at California State University, Sacramento. Welcome to you as well, Stephen.
Thank you, Ellen. Or Mary.
Sure. Phones are open as well. How has 9/11 affected you? And what does moving forward entail? 888-477-9499 is the number to call, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ellen, first to you. So it's been 15 years. Do these anniversaries ever get any easier?
Absolutely not. I don't think they get easier for anyone. The time marking now a commemorative year kind of pops up. I feel that some days it's been a minute and other days it's been 100 years. And I think that this is one anniversary that everybody shares. Everyone has a commonality to. And moving forward, everyone does pause and remember, like you said, exactly where they were that day and then have to continue on with their lives.
For those in the cockpit that day, it began like any other, with easy camaraderie. Could you tell us about that?
It did, and I even know after the fact, meeting the co-pilot's wife, he asked my husband, Vic, who was the captain, if he could make a phone call before they were doing their flight stuff. And he did, and he sang his children a good morning song like he does often. And so I know what the cockpit was like. Vic was a really great, easygoing guy, very strict in a thought process of taking his job very seriously, but also being able to be very human and open. And, of course, he had two young girls as well, so he said, go ahead and do that. And he even teased with him and said, if you keep that up, I'm going to put you on the loudspeaker. Mm-hmm. So it was an easy day start.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we know that it didn't end that way.
Chris Brennan, you and photographer Jim McMillan set out for New York after the first plane hit the World Trade Center. It was nearly impossible for you to get into Manhattan.
It was a bit of a journey, yeah. I first tried to get on a train, but the trains were at a dead stop, and then I got in a car and drove to Jersey City with a different photographer, and we got on a ferry and made it across to Lower Manhattan, and where we were immediately grabbed by the FBI and put back on the ferry and sent back to Jersey City. And then Jim and I got in another car and drove up to the Tappan Zee Bridge and across and all the way back down.
Were you just running on sheer adrenaline at that point?
Yeah, it was just, you know, get there. That was the mission of the day. I wrote at one point about how we were almost to Jersey City when 1010 Winds, which is a New York radio station, reported that a plane had crashed in Jenkintown. And the reporter or the photographer I was with, Dave Maioletti, and I, we wondered if we were supposed to stop and go back, you know, if, you know, maybe going to New York was, maybe we should be in Philadelphia. And I'll never forget this. We stopped at a McDonald's, and all the cell phones weren't working. So I found a payphone that was working. And I tried to call the Daily News newsroom, and I got a recorded message that said, due to a plane crash in your area, your call can't be completed at this time. And I didn't even know they had that as a recorded message. And then I called again, and the editor said that nothing had happened in Jenkintown and that the report was erroneous. And so we kept going.
Must have been surreal.
It was strange.
Stephen Brock, not going to ask this particular question of you as a doctor, but rather as an observer. Where were you during the attack? Were you on the West Coast? And what do you remember thinking?
Yeah, I was on the West Coast. It was early in the morning. I had just finished a run, and I remember coming back to the gym where my group and I met, and the TV was on. And I remember seeing the images of the first tower after it had been attacked and how surreal it was and how it really took a lot of energy, mental energy, to try to wrap my head around what was happening.
Professionally, Stephen Brock, you do a lot of work with children, and one of the facets we're looking at this hour is how 9/11 changed the landscape for young people, how they view their world. So guessing the group that's grown up since that day has a different view of the world and safety and security?
It really depends, and it depends to a significant extent on the adults in their lives. This is particularly true for younger children. Younger children, and by younger I mean second grade and below, tend to look to adults to figure out if something is scary, threatening, new, or different. And they, by and large, take their lead from those adults. So if the adults in their lives post 9/11 are behaving differently, if the adults in their lives post 9/11 are acting as if there's, you know, a dramatically increased threat or danger to personal security and safety, their children are going to follow their lead. Conversely, to the extent adults appropriately respond to the magnitude of the threat, the children are going to follow their lead as well. As they get older, our young people, our school-aged youth, are increasingly more able to independently judge the threat, judge the ongoing danger, and by the time you get into middle and high school, while they still look to adults for guidance, they're making increasingly independent decisions about, you know, are we in danger or not?
Yeah. Ellen, how old were your children at the time of 9/11?
10 and 13, and I do agree with what Stephen is saying, because I saw the difference in those two ages and how they reacted to things. My younger one did look to me for answers, but they both did. But my older daughter saw herself projecting herself immediately into the future. One of the things she said was, "Who's going to walk me down the aisle?" So she saw herself moving more towards the adult role, whereas my 10-year-old still needed to try to process, and I think she was looking for the guidance of where we were going to go.
And yet, at the time, of course, you are processing the fact that you've lost your husband. So how did you make it through as a family and as a mother?
Well, you know, on that day, I was actually at the school. I ran some volunteer programs, and we just stopped because nobody could concentrate and things were coming in. And I was really trying to find out some information because I had heard it was an American airplane, and I know some pilots. And I just went home and then saw it unfold on the TV. And I immediately, you know, found out the information that it was Victor, and tried to figure out, and I said, well, I'm leaving the kids in school. I can't process this right now on what I'm going to say to them. And before 10:30, United Airlines had called me up and said, we're releasing Victor's name. And I said, let's go. We have to pick up the girls. And so, you know, you go into mother role and protecting role, but when you are in shock and you're trying to figure out what just went on, it's a very difficult process. And so moving forward, um, I I did try to be there for my children, to really make it clear to them what was up. You know, my house turned into command central. I had pilots and flight attendants there. I had the safety advisor in his role with United Airlines. The FBI was coming to my house. I mean, it was crazy. And my girl said to me, we have to go to school tomorrow. We can't stay here.
Really?
And I immediately said, absolutely, you cannot. And they said, no, we have to leave. And I realized they did have to leave. And so we alerted the school. The teachers talked to all the students, and my girls went to school the next day. But coming home was also a different realization because of how other people had reacted with their children. Brielle came home and said, Mommy, we have to talk. And she made a motion across her neck area and said, that's what they're telling me happened to Daddy. And I said, you know, they'll never be able to prove exactly what happened, Brielle. And what you have to realize is that, and what I realize, and what I really believe, is that God was there with Daddy right at that moment. And he just took Daddy very quickly. And that's the choice that you have. You can take it, or you can think of anything else, but nobody else will be able to tell you what happened. And she said, you promise, Mommy? You know, it was this little, innocent little girl who needed to know that her daddy was safe at that point. Yeah.
So 15 years later, your girls are in their 20s, right? Are you still coming together as a family over 9/11? Is this something you still need to talk about, you still need to support each other in?
We definitely support each other, no matter where we are. You know, my kids, neither of them live right with me, but I have one daughter coming, the other daughter can't. We will be talking. We know we're there in each other's hearts for each other. And I noticed through the years, and as they've gotten older, they've learned coping skills on what they need to do and what's best for them. And that's what I'm so thrilled with, that they actually acknowledge what is their needs and what are their needs, and then they move forward with them.
Chris Brennan, just to get a sense of what you were experiencing, I'd like you to read a bit from some of the articles you wrote a few years back. This is about your experience at Ground Zero, and then we'll talk a little bit after the break. So.
Sure. The soot and papers covered just about everything inside the office building next door to the Trade Center. The windows of the first floor gym are all blown out, the shards of glass mixed into the powder. Weights and towels rest where the exercisers drop them. Jim snaps pictures through a frame of a former window while I root around in the paperwork, looking at the expense report of a man who spends $10,000 a month on dinners and flowers. Emergency medical teams are setting up in some of this space, but there are no survivors to treat or comfort. A firefighter starts talking about the many missing bodies. I had seen some parts, a torso in a uniform, a woman's hand with a wedding ring still on the finger. The firefighter holds up the handful of soot, letting it sift through his fingers. You know where they went? They were vaporized. They're right here.
And we'll talk about that some more in just a moment. Stay with us as Radio Times continues. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. 9/11, the anniversary, the 15th anniversary, is this Sunday. We're taking a look back and also talking about the ensuing 15 years and the generation which has grown up since the attack. Our guests include Ellen Saraceni. Her husband, Victor, was captain of United Flight 175, which was hijacked and then flown into the World Trade Center's South Tower. Chris Brennan writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He worked for the Philadelphia Daily News in September of 2001 and covered 9/11 from Ground Zero. And Stephen Brock is a professor and the school psychology program coordinator at California State University, Sacramento. Has 9/11 affected you? Have you moved beyond it? Lines are open at 888-477-9499, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we are getting some comments and calls in as we speak. Before we went to the break, Chris Brennan, you had read a passage from some of your writing about that day, and you're talking about a firefighter who holds up a handful of soot, letting it sift through his fingers, and the firefighter says, you know where they went? They were vaporized. They're right here. And this is, you know, you're there at the scene. This is what you're walking on, what you're breathing in, what you're touching. What prevented you from turning around and walking away?
It was so difficult to get there that it seemed unfathomable to leave. And then I eventually did have to leave because I had to file a story. I had to write. I had to get in touch with Philadelphia, let them know where I was and what I had to file, which was difficult because much of the telecommunications in Lower Manhattan was out. But when I did get through, an editor at the Philadelphia Daily News told me to turn around and go right back. So even if I'd wanted to leave, the Daily News wanted me to stay.
But as reporters, we try to remove ourselves to an extent from tragedy so we can report it. But considering, you know, you're in this building where so many people had died, and really, you know, the remains are all around you. How do you do this, and how are you able to do it fully with yourself?
It was such a bewildering day, or days, really, that there was just nothing to do but press forward and do the job, do the work. I was there. It was difficult to get in. I didn't know if I'd get back in if I wanted to. So, you know, it's just it's the job. I hope the job is never that day again. But while you're there, you have to perform.
Stephen Brock, we'd done a show a while ago about the stress that emergency responders, you know, journalists, of course, who have to report these things, emergency responders, police, firefighters, emergency medical folks experience when they're on a scene like this. How do you see this sort of situation and the coping skills that are needed to get through it?
Well, one thing I think, and Chris, I think, was alluding to this, that we need to appreciate and respect among first responders and reporters, for that matter, is the fact that to do their jobs and to do them well, they have to at least initially deny to a certain extent the reality of what they're going through. And that sort of avoidance coping or denial is something we see in individuals. I saw it in myself as I observed what was happening. And it's a coping strategy that essentially helps you get through the moment, through a difficult point in time. We do need to realize, and this is true for all of us, that there is a point, oftentimes later, you know, when you get home to a place where you're physically and emotionally safe, where you do to begin to confront the horror, the reality that you've just had to deal with. And that's when people like myself and family members and friends really need to be there for the individual who's experienced something traumatic like Chris went through.
Chris, you wrote about 5 years ago on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, "Back at home, I wake many nights aware, but wrong about where I am. I'm still there in my waking dream. This has the vividness of a nightmare, but not the feeling of horror." So has the horror, have you, 15 years later, have you gotten your head kind of wrapped around that, and have you been able to move forward?
Well, I don't have that dream anymore. For a long time, I had that dream that I was there. I would literally get out of bed and walk around my bedroom as if I was back at ground zero. But it wasn't like I was afraid. It was more like I was sleepwalking, I guess. And then the dream went away, and it took me a while to even notice that the dream did go away. But it did. But, you know, there are lingering effects. I was flipping through the channels last night watching television, and this time of year, it's almost unavoidable, all the videotape, the retrospectives. I don't watch any of it.
Let's get to some of the comments. Peter writes, "I've become numb to all this violence since 9/11. I mourn the loss of all the lives lost." Comment from Annabelle, "I was a sophomore in high school. I got up that morning and saw the towers on TV. I lived in California, so I was 3 hours behind the initial incident. I asked my mom if it was a movie. She said, no, that's New York. I didn't register the severity of the situation." Ellen Saraceni, you have made it your mission, one of your missions, to get secondary barriers installed for the cockpits of airplanes. What is a secondary barrier, and why is it needed?
Today, we are just as vulnerable as we were on September 11th. And in fact, I do say that we are more vulnerable this time right now, 15 years later, to a breach of the cockpit. The terrorists, and you can look at what they have said, what has been collected from their computers, and emails that they simply were waiting until the cockpit door opened up in flight, that they had no contingency plan in order to get into that cockpit. And that's exactly what they did. And today, what happens when you're on an airplane? The cockpit door opens. It opens multiple times. There are regulations saying many times that door has to be open. And it needs to be open for crew rest breaks, for restroom facilities, and for meals.
And this is the reinforced door that was, you know...
So the reinforced door was mandated by Congress.
Yes.
And absolutely had to happen. That's a good step forward. But operational use, since that has been installed, has shown us that during times in flight, the cockpit door opens up. So there is a lightweight, easy, inexpensive way to make sure that before that cockpit door opens up, there is another, it's like a big person baby gate. It gets locked into place, then the door can open up. Once the door closes, the gate can be moved back, and it means that the flight deck is secure, that no one can rush in and be able to get into our cockpits. And one of the reasons why I say we are more vulnerable and at a worse state right now since the fortified cockpit door has been put on is because Germanwings has proven this. If someone with ill intent gets behind that door, you cannot break that door down. So we need to take the precautions beforehand. And the secondary barrier has been evaluated in FAA studies. The airlines know about it. United Airlines started to install them right after the reinforced doors mm-hmm. were put on because they realized the vulnerability when that flight deck door opened up. And today, I've been 3 years down in D.C. I'm going to be going back in January and dropping another bill for legislation to mandate that every airplane, commercial passenger airplane, installs a physical secondary barrier so that we can protect and never allow what happened on September 11th to be repeated.
You have the support of Congressman Mike Fitzpatrick. You have the support of Senators Bob Casey and Pat Toomey, but there's no appetite overall in Congress at this point for it, or so far.
Yes,
right?
It's really a shame how Congress works. The things that are important sometimes get overlooked. This is a piece of safety equipment. There has never been a piece of safety equipment that's ever been put on an airplane without first multiple bloodshed, multiple accidents, and then an act of Congress. Congress did mandate the fortified cockpit door. The secondary barrier is only completing that mandate to make sure that the flight deck is not vulnerable.
Is it a money issue?
These United Airlines installed these for $3,500 per airplane that was put on an overnight installation when the aircraft was in for its regular maintenance. They pay $1 million for an in-flight entertainment system for the same airplane. So it's not cost. It is about the airlines not doing anything because they never do anything like this for safety until it is mandated. It's about the lobbyists who are fighting, and they're very strong for the airlines to do this. It's about Congress's inability to move forward on sometimes very common sense legislation. We have gotten unanimous consent in the House in committee to put secondary barriers on. Same thing when it went to the Senate. We got 100% that this was going to be put on all new aircraft. And yet when the short-term FAA reauthorization bill came out, that was not included. What was included, and they said safety issues were going to be included, what was included are things like the wait lines and TSA's issue with that. Mm-hmm. So how could you possibly think that something with a safety issue that's already been unanimously voted on cannot be included in this?
So Ellen Saraceni, you're going to continue to push forward.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. We're not safe today flying on an airplane, and we can repeat exactly what happened on September 11th, and shame on us.
I read, actually, that the secondary barrier as it stands is a flight attendant with a food cart.
Well, that's what they're using, and that was never meant to be a security procedure. It was just an interim method because they did realize the vulnerability, and they figured, let's do something. But the FAA study, which involved all of the stakeholders, proved that flight attendant and cart can be penetrated in under 2 seconds, and a breach of the cockpit can happen during that time. That's unacceptable.
Let's get to the phones. Louise in Norristown is standing by. Welcome to Radio Times, Louise.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. What's your question or comment?
Well, I was saying that I was a fifth grade teacher in suburban Philadelphia when 9/11 occurred, and it was a very difficult day for us as teachers and administrators because there was no blueprint for this. It was, you know, we did not know whether to tell the children or not tell the children or at what age, you know, what grade level should we tell them. And then all of a sudden the parents started showing up and taking their children out, and no one knew why that was happening. And it was just a very difficult time for the, you know, the staff and the teachers, because we also had to maintain some calmness and, you know, basically not acknowledge to ourselves what was going on.
Louise, thanks so much for the call to Radio Times. We're going to bring Stephen Brock into the conversation here about this. Stephen, you know, obviously a number of tragic incidents have happened since 9/11 in this country. Of course, there's the Paris attacks, San Bernardino, Orlando, etc. When something like this happens, what is the blueprint for working with children as a teacher and as a parent?
Well, I think one of the most important things that you want to do is let children's questions be your guide. They're going to tell you, essentially, through their questioning of you, what they need to know about an event. And then, with that in hand, you respond in a calm, controlled manner. To the extent it's appropriate and possible to do so, you absolutely reassure students, children, young children in particular, that they're safe, and you give them the factual information that they ask for. You don't want to, you know, be the person that brings to a young child's attention something that's going to be scary and frightening. But to the extent they're asking a question, you respond in a calm, controlled manner. You give them the facts. You give them the truth. You don't speculate. If they ask a question for which you don't have a really good answer, you validate that that's a good question, and you say as much.
So when news like this is breaking, the coverage is 24/7. When is it time to take a break from coverage, even as information's unfolding?
Yeah, the first time I really realized that impact was following the Columbine shooting, where I got up at 3 a.m. one time to take care of one of my younger children and happened to flip on CNN, and there were a group of students from Columbine High School. So the reality is, in today's 24/7 news cycle, that you can watch coverage of these events all the time. And of course, more recently, social media has just, you know, increased the impact of our exposure to these events. For adults, they can make adult decisions about how much to watch. But for children, it's really key that adults be there, watch the coverage with them, answer their questions, and at some point, turn it off. There is an association, and we learned this following the Oklahoma City bombing. There is an association between the amount of media coverage school-aged children watch following one of these scary, frightening events and the extent to which they experience traumatic stress, symptoms, for example, of post-traumatic stress disorder. So we need to carefully monitor it, and at some point, you know, when we think they have the information they need to kind of understand what has happened, you know, restrict their viewing.
Let's talk about, again, get back to the experience of first responders, and I'm going to ask you to skip a little bit of in the information that I gave you, Chris, and talking about Philadelphia firefighters. The Philadelphia Fire Department's Rescue One team, they told you that what happened on 9/11 was nothing less than an attack on their extended family.
That's right. They, if you like me, I could read from a story that I wrote while I was up in Manhattan. The task force has been using search dogs, fiber optic cameras, and sensitive listening devices to comb through the crater, which rescue workers now call the pile. Other members are using surveying equipment to determine if the rubble is shifting and could collapse. It is dangerous work in surreal surroundings. Along with the still falling debris and reigniting fires, the task force must also be wary of asbestos-laden dust, blood from what was once a fifth-floor blood bank,
tanks of diesel fuel stored in the Trade Center's seven-story basement to run emergency generators, and jet fuel from the terrorist-piloted jets that demolished the Twin Towers on Tuesday. Even the toner in the photocopiers is a hazardous material.
Are you in touch with some of these folks? Have you been in touch with them over the past 15 years, Chris?
I haven't been in touch with any of the rescue workers. I do sometimes share stories with the journalists.
Yeah, I was just curious to see how they were doing. All right. Again, we've got more comments and calls coming in to 888-477-9499. Also, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We have this comment from Mark. I'm Iraqi by birth and citizenship. I was 11 at the time and recall being in my third grade classroom when the news first came out during the late afternoon. There was a 7-hour time difference, I guess. I remember everyone being extremely confused at first, especially the teachers and the kids hypothesizing what it was all about. Shortly after, I went home and saw my parents watching the news intently. I remember the chatter at the time and was extremely worried that something would happen to Iraq as a result of that heinous act. Again, we're talking about the 9/11 terror attacks. The 15th anniversary is this Sunday. And in studio, we have Ellen Saracini. Her husband, Victor, was captain of United Flight 175, which was hijacked and then flown into the World Trade Center South Tower. Chris Brennan reported from Ground Zero while he was working for the Philadelphia Daily News. He's currently with the Inquirer. And Stephen Brock is on the line with us. He's a professor and the School Psychology Program Coordinator at California State University, Sacramento. The conversation continues in just a moment on Radio Times. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are taking a look back this hour at the 9/11 terror attack 15 years this Sunday. Chris Brennan reported from Ground Zero while he was working for the Philadelphia Daily News. He is currently writing for the Inquirer, and he's in studio with us. Ellen Saracini, her husband Victor Saracini, was captain of United Flight 175, which was one of the planes hijacked, and it was flown into the World Trade Center South Tower. And Stephen Brock is on the line with us. He's a professor and the School Psychology Program Coordinator at California State University in Sacramento. The number to call if you'd like to join this conversation is 888-477-9499, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Time. So Ellen, you've overseen the development of a memorial garden, which is located in Lower Makefield, Bucks County. Describe it for us and tell us, what does it do for you?
Well, the Garden of Reflection is in Bucks County, and it is full of symbolism. We really are very fortunate not to be a crash site, so our representation of September 11th can be a little bit different than what you would normally have. What we are in the state of Pennsylvania is the official Pennsylvania memorial to the victims of September 11th. In Lower Makefield Township, where the memorial is located, we lost the most amount of people per capita in the state of Pennsylvania. And so the garden is symbolism. There are 18 Bucks County victims. We have 18 trees representing them. We have 9 trees representing the 9 from Lower Makefield. We have remnants of the World Trade Center structure, and that's how you walk in. It's located in a teardrops shape forecourt before you get into the memorial, and it takes you on a memorial journey. You walk past all 2,977 names that are etched in glass, and you come to the core, the heart of the memorial. There are 2 voids that are in a pool, in the center of a pool, and they represent the void of the World Trade Center towers, but more meaningfully, the void that we now that has encompassed us. And coming from those 2 voids are twin fountains and representing new life rising. In that inner circle, we have the 18 Bucks County names also etched in glass. And the memorial can bring you to a different place. I remember a long time ago somebody said to me, I went to your memorial with trepidation, and I left with such a feeling of peace as I left. So this memorial is there for everyone. And you know, we have high school students asking if they can take their prom pictures there. We have people
really
wanting to take wedding pictures there. Mm. It really is a very beautiful, peaceful place, even though you can incorporate the fact that it is a memorial to all those that we lost on that day.
Are you still in touch with some of the families in the Bucks County area?
Yes, a lot of them still live there, so they're all involved. I mean, I specifically have started a 501c3, and we fundraise and try to keep it very much in the public, because while the memorial is there, it's not going to stay there if we don't take care of it. And the fundraising efforts of this 501c3 will go to a perpetual endowment that will support the garden over the lifetime of the garden.
What's the ballpark figure to keep it going?
Well, we figured that $2 million invested would generate enough money that the income from that would support the memorial in perpetuity. And we're over a quarter of the way there. Our fundraising efforts continue. We have a 5K coming up. It's our 13th annual. We just finished our 13th annual golf. And this year, we have some fun events too. And what if you're not in the area, you still can participate in fundraising. Steven Singer has created a wonderful 9/11 commemorative this year, Never Forget Pin. Steven's been a great guy, and that's a big campaign going on. But we also have two virtual events, and it's a virtual 5K and it's a virtual golf. And so no matter where you are, you can get on the Garden Reflection website, you can register. Last year we had somebody who usually runs in the 5K, and he's a pilot and he was working. So we got a picture of him that he sent in after he ran his 5K, and he had the last year's shirt on for the 5K. But he was standing on the Spanish Steps. So it's great. It's a way to involve people. When people say, I felt so helpless, or even today, what can I do? There is something you can do. You can take action to make sure that a 9/11 memorial that represents everyone that we lost that day is there for future generations to remember and honor.
How are the families doing in Bucks County, the ones you're in touch with?
You know, if you talked to me a couple months ago, I could maybe say one thing. And if I talked to you right at this time frame, you know, over the years, you get this. It just happens. It is uncontrollable for you. And it just happens that this time frame changes who you are, your thought process, how you're feeling involuntarily. And so you go through the motions of functioning. But the tragedy is a world tragedy. It hasn't left anyone, so we can't expect that somebody who lost someone intimately on that day can now handle that day where it's just ease. But the amount of people who come and are there for the family members really makes it that we all are one big family. We all have taken a really hard loss on September 11th, and we remember and we honor, and that's what's important.
Back to the phones, Dave, in Maple Glen, Pennsylvania. You're live on Radio Times. Hi, Dave.
Thank you. Hi. I think that it's fine to memorialize all the people who died, which was a horrible tragedy, but the real memorial to all the people involved would be to have an honest and open, unpolitical investigation into what really happened, which we've never had. The co-chairs of the investigative committee that investigated it have themselves said that they don't know what happened because they were lied to by the government, they were not given the information they asked for, and there has never been an explanation or any punishment of the people whose massive incompetence, like the CIA director at the time, George Tenet, who was given an award instead of being fired. So, you know, that would be the honoring of this 15th year anniversary, would be to get a real, honest, open, unpolitical, aggressive investigation into how this could have happened.
Thanks, Dave, for the call to Radio Times. You're nodding your head, Ellen.
That's very true. The 9/11 Commission was set up to have an investigation, and they had a deadline, a timeline. And they had to produce all the information on a certain day. And they weren't ready. They had been given information later on that had not been investigated, and their recommendation was that a second investigation be happening, continuing on, but also being able to incorporate the information that was not in the first. And today we have 28 pages that still have, you know, like the declassification of that. It shows involvement from people that should it should be known, but because they're have relationships with the United States, we're going to go ahead and protect them. That's just wrong. So we should be investigating. We should be finding out, because we're not safe until we do, and they have to be held accountable.
Let's go back 15 years, 8:30 in the evening, September 11th of 2001. President Bush addresses the nation. He characterizes the attacks as evil, despicable acts of terror, and says America and its allies would stand together to win the war against terrorism. It's what I'm gathering the nation needed to hear at the time. But Chris Brennan, the reality 15 years later is very different.
Well, sure. I mean, we went into Afghanistan and then we went into Iraq. One arguably was a sensible act of war. The other was a terrible misadventure, which may have helped given rise to ISIS, the invasion of Iraq. So I think with time we gain perspective on this terrible event of September 11th. But speaking as a political reporter, I don't think we the more time you put between an event, the more politics you get, not the less, unfortunately.
As the reality of terrorism continues, Stephen Brock, you know, over the past few years we've heard, you know, new and frankly disturbing vocabulary, words and phrases like lockdown and an active shooter. And should we ration these terms when addressing the young?
Can you say that again, please, Mary?
So as we, I guess, have grown accustomed to living in a world of terror, if you can put it that way, there's new vocabulary that we're using. And in terms of, you know, whatever the act might be, whether it is an act of international terrorism or domestic terrorism, there are terms like active shooter and lockdown. Are these words, do we need to ration these terms when addressing the young?
Yeah, we need to be very careful about how we use them. Last time I crunched these numbers, the odds of a student, a school-aged youth, age 5 to 18, being the victim of a school-associated violent death was 1 in 4.5 million. A violent death is more likely to occur at home than it is in school. So we need to be very careful as we explain these real threats to our school-aged youth, to help them understand the magnitude of the danger. The reality is, speaking specifically now about schools, it's arguably the safest place for a young person to be. You're more likely, a child is more likely to be the victim of a homicide in a restaurant. And by the way, I haven't heard any comments about arming waitresses. More likely be to the victim of a homicide in a restaurant than they are in school. So we really need to be careful about the use of these terms, and we need to assess their effectiveness. Now, the traditional lockdown drill. The Sandy Hook Commission issued a report, and one of their first recommendations was that all classrooms be able to lock their doors from the inside. The fact of the matter is there's never been an incident where a classroom has been attacked through a locked classroom door. We know, we've also done some studies on lockdown drills. We know that they do result in adaptive, appropriate behavior when you need to lock down, and it actually, to a certain extent, reduces anxiety about the circumstances that may need to locking down and sheltering in place. But, you know, as we start to talk about active shooter drills and those kinds of things, I get the idea behind giving adults in an environment some choice and control about how to respond, but we absolutely need to be careful.
Yes, especially
how
since
we frame this for children.
Yeah, because especially since the odds are so great, or
yeah,
so little. I mean, it's what one.
What
I'm trying to say.
4.5 million.
There
right.
You go. Something to keep in mind. And is this does this go along with the? It's called the Prepare system that I think you've authored.
Yeah, my colleagues and I, with the National Association of School Psychologists, have put out what we call the PREPARE curriculum. It's an acronym, and it basically speaks to how schools can better, pardon the pun, prepare themselves to prevent and then, if the need be, respond to these scary, frightening, and potentially traumatic circumstances.
And you say, Stephen Brock, that at the end of the day, most people after these events do move forward and are able to cope and get past them.
Correct. That's the basic default assumption. And to the extent you're surrounded by a loving, caring network of family and friends, that's a high probability. It's really a small percentage of the population that has real long-term negative effects.
Ellen Saraceni, I don't think we got to this when we were talking about the Memorial Garden earlier. There is a candlelight remembrance scheduled?
Yes. Every year we remember what happened on that day in the morning, marking the chronological events. And at night, we now have, for the past few years, have a remembrance ceremony. Every year it has a different theme. This year it is about first responders and how the call to action came and the response later on. First responders started immediately, and really the first true first responders were the flight attendants and pilots and then the passengers. And it trickled down, so we will go through and mark that chronology.
Is it in the evening? When is it exactly?
On September 11th at 7 p.m. at night at the Garden of Reflection. And this year, what we are doing, we are bringing children into this. It's the 15th commemorative year. 15-year-olds will be involved in the ceremony. They will follow a torch lighting, and each one is representing what happened at a certain time, and then the torch will be lit, and it will be bringing the from darkness into the light.
So moving forward, Ellen, what are some of the more challenging moments for you 15 years after you lost your husband?
I think that when I am walking the halls of Congress and I see how hard it is to move things forward that are common sense and that we need, that's very difficult. I think that I think of my children, and my one daughter is going to be married next year. What a wonderful thing, and it's going to be lovely and happy. But it brings me back to that time when she said, "Who's going to walk me down the aisle?" I think that my children have had lots of struggles all along in these years. They've come out very victorious in their movement forward, healthy. Healthy-minded, healthy-spirited. It's something that you have to look at. Time does not heal. Time just brings you into the new reality of where you live.
Ellen Saraceni, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you.
Ellen's husband, Victor Saraceni, was a captain of United Flight 175, which was hijacked and flown into the World Trade Center South Tower. Chris Brennan writes for The Inquirer. He reported from Ground Zero while working for the Philadelphia Daily News 15 years ago. Great to have you here, Chris.
Always good to be.
Thanks so much. And Stephen Brock, professor and the School Psychology Program Coordinator at California State University, Sacramento. We appreciate the time.
Thanks, Mary.
And take care. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Good to have you along for Radio Times.